You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Members of FC Bergman, welcome to Token Theater Friends. I'm very happy to be talking to you today.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about what 300L times 50L times 30L is all about?
Well, it's about a little village that's very secluded somewhere in an unknown forest. A village where time stood still more or less for we don't know how many years, and where people are living their lives more or less in sort of a loop, so on a sort of neurotic, very self-centered way. And on a certain moment, and that's where our play begins, the oldest inhabitant of the village leaves his house and disappears in the forest. And this is the beginning for a certain outbreak of fear in the village. People don't get why this old man is leaving. We think probably he's just old and he's going to die somewhere in silence, but the people, the other inhabitants of the village, become very confused and they start to panic. This panic leads to sort of an anxiety psychosis, which increases and becomes worse and worse and worse, till this village collectively thinks that the big flood is coming over them. So they are starting to get lots of like biblical visions and signs of the apocalypse. At the ending, they're like losing their minds and seeking for redemption, which is not really in their reach. Voila.
I love that you said that you think the character is going somewhere, but you're not sure where the character is going. So can you talk a little bit about not necessarily having control of the fate of your characters? Like, do you stop writing? Do you stop developing the pieces and then just set your characters free?
Yeah, of course, we have the story made up for ourselves, but it's like, it's a very, the narrative is quite simple. And we left lots of space very intentionally for
interpretation
and in that way also participation of the audience. So it's like people can create their own stories and their own narratives, because it's so open. We always try to create, as we call it, open artworks. It's not that we want to communicate. Of course, we want to communicate lots of things, but it's not that we want to communicate one clear statement or story. It's, for us, it's very important that the audience really is participating and creating its own interpretation and artwork.
We don't use text. So also not in this performance. So that gives actually we work very visual. We call it sometimes like a symphony of images, and that makes it easier to create like these open artworks, that there is not a text-based strict narrative to be followed.
So you developed the piece 11 years ago, and I read that you developed it in a month, and yet 11 years later, it perfectly speaks about how, you know, the world, how we all live during the pandemic, how we're living, some of us, during a pandemic in this state of isolation. So can you talk a little bit about how, if at all, the meaning of the piece has changed for you, the creators, during the pandemic?
It's actually, yeah, the first time since we played it since the pandemic. So for us, it's kind of new to see it in this
context.
In this context, of course. But I think, as we mentioned, this idea of this open artwork, and I think if you create pieces like that, that hopefully have like a very universal themes, that you can project it on every difficult political situation or so. So when we played, for instance, in Athens a few years ago, it's already, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that. It was in the middle of this euro crisis where the Greek people were really, they were almost pushed out of this eurozone, and they had like big financial troubles, and they felt also isolated in this world or in Europe or whatever. And they read it strictly in that sense. So it's always nice that if you perform a performance such a long time, that over the years, different kind of meanings pop up. And so now when you talk about actually the corona crisis and the pandemic and the isolation, and it's actually the first time that I thought about it, I have to say honestly. But I think it perfectly fits on our time of fear. I think it's a time of fear at this point, not only for this pandemic, but also for, let's say a war in Ukraine and these kind of things. And of course, this performance is also about fear and about, instead of opening up, closing everything down in yourself or in your little community and don't want to let people go out of it, because that's danger.
And unfortunately, collective fear is something of all times, apparently.
Yeah, and it's still for 11 years a very actual and very very on the edge of time, I think. So that's a little bit of a sad thought.
There's also something really beautiful about this idea of containing a world, like an entire universe, on stage. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how, you know, the work that you do, how did it give you solace during the pandemic? You know, were you trying in your homes when we were in lockdown to create the worlds that you wanted to be in?
Yeah, actually, we started quite soon working again together. So we were like in a lockdown for 6 weeks, really the tough one. But then we started working in a small room, and we only saw each other. And that was the sheep song that we created, and you feel it in the performance that it's been made in a different kind of atmosphere or a different kind of life. So it's something that we took along and we used it, I think.
It was crazy time, of course, for all the world, but it was, the first time that we created something with an avondklok.
Curfew.
With a curfew. At the end of the rehearsal day, we had to, like, we had permission on a piece of paper that we could go to from the theater to our houses after 10 p.m. And it was feeling a little bit like prohibition time or something. It was very strange.
It was
strange.
Very consoling to have each other.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we had nothing.
Yeah.
And you've also spoken about how important having an audience is. So how exciting is it to have an audience again?
It was so sad. We had our opening night with six people in the theater, and it was really depressing. And then again, you can.
Yeah, because we really didn't realize. Yeah, it wasn't clear at all if we had succeeded, if we were communicating
something.
And luckily we got this feeling when we first performed it for a real audience, but it was so bizarre
and confusing
and also it really shows how important that the contact and the meeting with an audience is for the existence of a piece of art.
Yeah, we really rediscovered that art is about communication. And when there is no one on the other side, it doesn't make sense at all to create something or to show something or to do something at all. Yeah. So that was and particularly for our performances, I guess, because, yeah, you need the audience to give meaning to a performance, because they're so open also. You need them. You need to have this dialogue between the stage and the venue and the people.
And also the scale of the performances we create is quite big most of the time. So it's also very weird to perform like this big scaled stuff we're always making big gestures, and it's strange to make such big gestures when there's like almost nobody in the venue. It feels very awkward.
I don't want to sound too American, but how do you measure then how successful a work is?
We don't.
Well, when is a work successful? Yeah, yeah, it's a I don't difficult know. Question.
Of course, we're really happy that we can perform for so many people. And we performed this piece already more than, I don't know, 60, 70 times for full houses all over Europe. And now for the first time in the States or on another continent than Europe. So that's really special, of course, and that's an honor. But I think it's important that you don't work towards success and only towards, I don't know, your own artistship or something. That's the only criterium you have, I think, in creating. But of course it's incredible to what happens to us right now.
Using cinematic elements, obviously the camera is such an important part of the work that you do. And thinking about this piece, I couldn't help but think about Lars von Trier's Dogville, which is in so many ways about this isolated village, and also about how, you know, someone at some point leaves. And I wonder, obviously, maybe influences are unconscious sometimes, but can you identify any influences that came into play when you were doing this piece?
Very Scandinavian for that piece.
and it's true that we were actually influenced a lot by Lars von Trier, but not necessarily
Dogville,
but maybe more by Antichrist than Dogville. The spiritual and religious atmosphere that's going through Antichrist, and the secluded feeling of the Scandinavian forests. And also, I think maybe the biggest influence is the work of Scandinavian Swedish director Roy Andersson, who was really for us at that time a discovery. And I think when you watch his movies, it's inevitable to see certain comparisons. And it was actually funny because Roy Andersson creates very few works. So I think back in the days he only created three movies, and then we created
this one,
and afterwards he created his fourth movie. And when we went to see it in cinema, we saw some scenes that were in our performance, and that they were in his movie. But of course he didn't see our performance, but it was stunning.
It felt so familiar.
Yeah, it felt really familiar.
And for the rest, almost kind of like. Sorry, go ahead.
And for the rest, we're Belgians, and more specific Flemish Belgians, and so inevitably we became very much inspired by art and by also the visual arts from the Netherlands and like the southern Netherlands and Flanders. So the Flemish primitives and the surrealists. So I think that's also a world where that inspires us a lot, the world of visual arts.
I was actually in Ghent pretty recently. I didn't make it all the way to Antwerp, but I love this sense of almost like time being frozen in Ghent. And that's also something that, if I'm not being presumptuous, something that you do in your work, like this idea of almost like having snow globes of pieces, like snow globes of universes that you want to preserve. And I wonder for each of you individually, if you're willing to share, of course, are there any experiences outside of the work that you've done that you would love to preserve in a snow globe kind of object?
Oh, too many.
Oh, it's an interesting question. But
I think for me, the first thing that comes to mind is our little girl. We have a daughter together, and she's like growing and growing, and you want to like preserve her in a in a glass. What's it called? Bell
snow
jar.
Globe. Yeah,
snow globe. To see how little and cute she is.
And of course, like trying to conservate or preserve stuff is has something very poetic, but also something quite sad, because of course the assumption is also very it's in vain already when you in the attempt. So I heard, for example, that Jacques Brel he rented till the end of his life his old room where he stayed as a student when he was 18 years old, and he kept his room and he rented it till he died, and it's I totally understand it, because it's something, it's really about trying to grasp something that's just not maybe a period in life or a feeling or a scent or I don't know, but of course it's also it's not possible, it's just not possible, and maybe that's sort of a constant in the work we create. We also, for example, created a performance 7 years ago, The Land of Nod, where we recreated the, or rebuilt on a realistic scale a museum room, museum hall of the Museum of Fine Arts in Antwerp, which is of course quite a megalomaniac attempt. But it's also like building a big tree house or something, but it's the attempt is in the same time quite ridiculous, I think, and maybe it's this attempt that we find so touching and so so moving.
So it's almost like you've always been trying to build Noah's Ark in a way, right?
Indeed.
I love that you mentioned Roy Anderson's work, because my favorite thing about his movies is that each vignette is almost like it starts off as watching a painting almost, or a sculpture, and then it comes to life. So are there any artworks that you would love to just like dive into and live in?
I think the most beautiful works of art are mostly also quite like sad
or
dark or melancholic. So it's not so like really
living in it.
Is,
maybe in Godard's movies.
Yeah,
it's nice living
that's a
there.
Good one.
That's a good one. Yeah.
I mean, since he recently passed away and he had such an incredible life, which are your favorite Godard movies?
Oh. Yeah, of course, Bande à part, but also Pierrot le Fou and Le Mépris. Yeah, like the big ones, the classics. But like Pierrot le Fou is such a genuine piece of art. It's really incredible, I think.
But I love Contempt, so I kind of wish that I could live in that one with all these beautiful colors and everything. Maybe not live in it permanently because it's too dark.
Wow, yeah, it's beautiful.
Or of course the Talented Mr. Ripley. It's also a classic, like the world of.
Is it Frank Godard?
No, it's not Godard.
Ah, okay, another example. Okay.
No, it's Frank Langella. I think the one
original.
We are talking about.
Ah, you mean the American one?
Yeah, the American one. So. The Talented Mr. Ripley, the atmosphere of like Capri and Italy in the 50s, it's really great.
But then being Jude Law rather than than the other
Matt
one.
Damon.
Matt Damon.
I mean, I don't think you want to be in the boat with Matt Damon when that happens.
Like the first half of the movie, and then just get out.
So the way in which you incorporate cameras and the way in which you incorporate cinematic techniques in your work is almost very Godardian, where you're like constantly playing with the form. Have you found ever something that you wanted to do that you couldn't pull off because you didn't know how to?
Yeah, we must have.
Like specifically with camera or with like with the cinema stuff?
Or poetically? Or
yeah, combining the different techniques and the different mediums.
I think the struggle is more often in the context of the content more than the technical capacities, no?
Yeah.
We're always looking for some kind of Notzak, what is that?
Urge.
Yeah.
Then and of course you have the boundaries of the money.
Because there's always have that.
Yeah, the inspiration or the ideas for like going totally insane with all kinds of technical gear and stuff is endless, but
tempting.
Yeah, and tempting, but yeah, of course there's also.
But for us, it's really important that in using a camera on stage, that of course it's also theater. So what's so interesting is that the movie is shot live and that it's here and now. But what makes it always difficult is that you don't want to create like images that you can also see on stage, but also on screen, and that you double.
Finding that balance.
Finding that balance is always actually the most difficult part of working with a camera.
Yeah.
Because you want to create theater, but you also want to create a movie. And when you just do it on top of each other, then it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it's just.
But if they fight each other too much, it's also not good. So it's really finding, yeah.
And it's becoming empty technical use of technique of cameras, these kind of things.
It should be meaningful at all times, but it's
people often ask us when do you guys make a movie? You should make a movie, but it's like it's really what we do is totally something different. It's really what Thomas just mentioned. It's a different language, the combination of theater and cinema. So I totally don't have to pretend, or we don't totally don't have the pretension. That we can make movies because that's really it's another form of art. What we do is like taking lots of elements out of cinema, but it's to be like a genuine movie artist. That's really something else, I think.
So at a time when social media, like things like TikTok and Twitter, are so prevalent and like everything basically is about text, how do you find working with almost no text in a world that constantly demands that everything's digested for the audience, that everything's explained, that everything has meaning?
I think the opposite is also true.
Yeah,
that the world today is about image. You're really flooded by images all the time. Instagram, it's really about. So I think that's also something.
People are so spoiled by like and they're totally like a goose, totally stuffed with images of all sorts and all kinds. So it's more the difficulty is to keep their attention in this slow form of art that theater is in the end. It's here and now, and it's quite. It has its own time, and it's quite slow. The audience is maybe not so much used anymore to like just sit down and concentrate for more than an hour on something that just goes on in its own pace. But I think when we started with our company 15 years ago now. People were more they were more looking for what does this mean? What are you trying to tell us? And I think that evolved a little bit. I think people are more open now for like being fed by images, as long as they can keep their concentration.
Have you noticed anything interesting or peculiar or very particular about the way in which different audiences have reacted to this particular piece all over the world?
Like for instance, the Greek people I mentioned already, and the people in Athens. But then we had like a group from China once. We didn't play in China, but we played at Ruhr Triennale in Germany. And there was a big group of Chinese audience that came, and they didn't have a clue of any biblical reference we used. So
the whole religious layer was unknown to them.
And of course,
it was so interesting to hear how they interpreted this piece, not being influenced by all the references. But it was not so different, actually.
No.
So after reading about your work, I went into a rabbit hole of like Noah's Ark mythology and all this stuff. And I was so fascinated by the fact that a cubit, if I'm not mistaken, was the measurement that was like from your elbow to the top of your middle finger. And it made me think a lot about how I've read how when you first started, you were more tactile with, you know, you did everything yourself, you built the sets. And now you're at a point where other people do that. So how has that, you know, not doing that anymore affected the work? Like, have you found that you now have more time to do other things? Have you found that you have developed skills that maybe when you were building the sets, you couldn't perform?
Yeah, of course. When we started 15 years ago, we were much younger and we had lots of time. We had so much time. So creating something could last for, sometimes we work for a year on a project, and then we just, because we're not like very skilled technicians or builders, so we could easily try to build a wooden shack, for example, as in this performance, as in 300L, like we had time too much. So now we are older and we have families and we have more work. So there's no time anymore to lose.
So luckily we can just sit at the table together for like 8 hours a day for like 2 months and find everything.
But it was a nice way of developing our stuff. Just being on the atelier and it really went similar. Simultaneously, the conception of the material and the physical creation, which was really special. But now it's more the creation happens more like at the table.
I think the performances now are more thought through. Than 15 years ago, of course. There we could have like crazy ideas without any clue why, or that we just do it. But I think it's
not true for this performance because we made the scenario.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. For instance, for walking on the Champs-Élysées, etc.
Yeah, it was really intuitive.
Very intuitive, but I think it more also it also has to do with the we were 20, so and now we're 15 years older. You cannot hide it. It doesn't make sense to try to look for the energy of when you were 20. So the performances will change, of course, over the years, because we're getting older also, and maybe, I don't know, have
harder
other...
Harder for ourselves as well.
Yeah, harder for ourselves. We don't want to repeat ourselves. So we're asking much more questions. We became much more professional also. So that's something that changed, of course, a lot. But I think every artist goes through these kind of different stages in his life over his career. And now we're somewhere, hopefully halfway or even a little before halfway.
But it feels quite special to be here in New York, in this marvelous Harvey Theater, and just look at the set we built it ourselves 11 years ago. And it's really a very, I can say, it's a very crappy crappy set. It's falling apart if you touch it, because it's so old and it's like, yeah, but it, and we're here, and it's, for us, it's a big deal to be here in New York with this stupid handmade set. It's really something. It's something. Yeah.
Going back all the way to 15 years ago, when you started working together, you were in school. So what drew all of you to each other? How did you know that you wanted to work together?
We didn't. No. It came by.
We just happened to work.
We were invited. Yeah. We were invited by a little festival, by a squat house somewhere in the border of Antwerp. And we decided during summer break, we were all still studying. Some of them
already left
at theater school. I was studying visual arts. So it was really like, okay, let's do something again in summer. And then after that performance, we said, oh, maybe we can do a little performance. We were asked for another little performance. And then it started rolling, actually, without any plan. We didn't have any career plans at all. So it was a bit by coincidence, and that we're sitting here still 15 years later. And there came somebody to the school, to the conservatory where we studied, to ask, will you guys create something for a little festival? And it's just the people in our class who said, okay, I'll be part of it. Those people became FC Bergman. And other people didn't, because they just hadn't the time that summer, or they weren't
going
interesting. So it's a very, the group, the it's a very, it's the formation of the group was created by coincidence.
You think so?
I don't know. That's maybe a more spiritual way of thinking about it.
So I love that the name of your troupe is a wordplay, because it's football club and also something else. I forgot what it was, because I think it's, was it French? I don't remember what it was. But thinking about Bergman, and thinking about football for a second, and thinking about like Ingmar Bergman, I don't know, being the captain of a football team, who else would be in your ideal football team?
Of course, Godard, as we mentioned.
Pina Bausch,
probably. Anne-Thérèse Dakersmaker. I also think Paul Thomas Anderson.
Wes Anderson, maybe. And Roy Anderson.
Three Andersons. but also Rubens, or
Michael Jackson, maybe, but you can't say that anymore.
You can't say that anymore. The list is endless, I think.
More than 11.
Yeah.
More than 11, that's fair. So some of them can be on the bench. So just to wrap up, I read that you often describe your pieces as beasts that you want to tame, or beasts that have to be tamed. And thinking about Noah's Ark, if it's possible for you to choose two pieces of yours that would be the beasts that you would put in this, you know, like imaginary Noah's Ark, what would those two pieces be? Like, which of your pieces would you pair?
I think we have to choose for Terminator Trilogy, just because it was really a project that was growing above our heads, and we really couldn't. It was a site-specific project in open air, and it was enormous. And we were still also very young, and we had to really fight with the elements, with the wind and with the rain, and it was totally. We were feeling lost in La Mancha, as the Terry Gilliam documentary. It was really growing above our heads. So this beast we almost couldn't tame. And I think only for this reason already it was a very special project. Also because it was the first project that was not an immediate success by the audience, but we really felt like, okay, but it's not like communicating already what we want to, but it's feeling like very, very much what we want to communicate. So it was a very special project. Huh?
And the other one, the other beast we almost, were killed by was JR. This adaptation of the novel, of William Geddes.
About New York, about the city of New York, and where we built a skyscraper, a little skyscraper of like 14 meters high. With
the audience was sitting all around, so you could only see 1/4 of the performance live. But we also had two camera guys, one of them was Thomas, who were in this skyscraper, and we had a simultaneous movie.
Well, it was like, so the tower, you could see the performance from 4 sides. So we also had to direct the performance 4 times, and it was a total madhouse. So
it was way too difficult.
Yeah, but we succeeded, luckily. But it was also like really crushing us almost. And I think maybe that's also a sort of an evolution we went through the last years, that we used to look for these kinds of challenges, like the bigger the beast, the better. And maybe that's now we're like walking a sort of a different path. We are more purifying, I think, our poetics and our language. And the last performance we created, the Sheep Song, is still, it's quite huge, but it's more like, it's about theater, and it's more maybe in the boundaries of theater. And yeah, it's not so untamable anymore, but
otherwise we would be dead by now. So it's like,
yeah.
So obviously you don't want to draw meaning for your audience, right? Like at all. But I wonder if you're willing to share, what are some of your favorite elements in the set and in the piece that maybe you want some audience members to take a look at? Like maybe something that you're just obsessed with because you love how it looks, or because it's something that you built and it means something to you sentimentally.
For me, it would be the drowned sheep. I think that's my favorite part of this performance.
Yeah, for me, it would be the interior of the house of the old man who's sleeping at the first house. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful
little set
to wander around, actually. Yeah, full of references towards this Ark of Noah story.
The nice thing is when we started 11 years ago touring this performance, we also did the build up ourselves. So now we have technicians who do it for us, thank God. But back then we did it ourselves, and it was quite nice to have the feeling to make up the beds and shake up the pillows for the actors who came into the house. So we were like, one day, just very precisely going to this little houses, these little sets, and
reconstructing this world every time
and
again,
adding little details for our actors to surprise them. And it was really, really nice to really build something not only for the audience but also for as sort of a gift for the actors who came later and will live in these little sets. So, and I think that's the feeling still remains today. It's because we don't perform it, we perform it already for 11 years, but not very regularly. So mostly 1 or 2 times a year. So it's every time again, sort of a family reunion with the actors who also became 11 years older, of course. And every time again, they are like re-entering their houses and, yeah, and it's also, it's like every time again, catching up with the story of 11 years ago. So I think there's a big poetry in it.
That's really beautiful. So the piece runs from September 28th through October 1st at Van. Yeah. Is there anything that you want to tell American audiences who don't know your work and you want to invite to the piece?
I think we want to tell them as little as possible and just come and watch it.
And what we always really ask is, please don't try to crack the code, or because there isn't any code to crack. Just be as open as possible and just become inspired and let yourself drown into the experience. And then we're so happy.
Drown is a perfect word for this piece, I think. So thank you so much for your time, and break a leg, enjoy your time in New York, and please have a bagel for me because I'm far away right now. and I miss bagels.
You will. Very well. Okay. Thank you for the conversation.
Have a good time in Europe.
Yeah. Bye.
Thank you so much.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.